Today on Piled High and Deep, the podcast, it's the journey of a food scientist from Utah. After a mission in Costa Rica and a battle with cancer, he turned his passion for cooking and a fascination with chemistry into a PhD that focused on the making of crab sticks. You know those fake crab flakes you find in your California roll?
And so what we were trying to understand is how these different myosins performed. And so I had a bunch of different testings that I would do. So doing some dynamic rheology where we'd put it between a couple plates and it would rotate back and forth to see how viscoelastic it was. So to see how much rubberiness it would get as we heated up.
From fish to hot dogs to beef, he also brought me a really tasty summer sausage. We're piling it high and deep today with a meat scientist. Piled High and Deep, the podcast, is created by Mountain Geek Productions. That's me, Ted Conti. Check out my writings and other fun stuff at themountaingeek.net. You can also follow the podcast on Twitter at PhD Podcast, on Facebook at Piled High and Deep, the podcast. I'm also on Twitter at The Mountain Geek. Well, let's get chatting about some food. You might want a sandwich after this thing is done. Zach, thanks for joining me. Really appreciate it. We're here in my kitchen because it just seemed appropriate that when I talk to a meat scientist, I should do it when he's about 5 feet from my wonderful big stove right there. And the weather here in Denver is such that I did think about doing this outside near the Weber Grill. But Zach Reed, thank you very much for joining us on Piled High and Deep today.
No problem. I'm excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
So, Zach, we were chatting a little bit here before, and I want to say thank you also for the sausage that you brought me. Tell me about what you made and what's now sitting in my fridge.
So that's some summer sausage. So at work, you know, we're doing all sorts of different test treatments where we're testing out starches and different things like that. So I'm making a bunch of different hot dog formulations. So in case something goes wrong, I always order some extra meat. So after a while, once I've got that, you know, it's been frozen, I'll go ahead and make a 25, 30 pound batch of summer sausage. Right. So we had some extra, so I made some summer sausage and thought I'd bring you some of that.
Well,
up
thank
today,
you very much. So. Is that smoked afterwards? Or
yeah, so it's smoked, it's cured, got a little bit of nitrite in there.
Okay.
And then we throw that in the smokehouse. Smoke it up. It's got a fibrous casing so that the smoke can penetrate in there and give it the flavor and
right.
Everything. So, you know, it's similar to a lot of the, you know, Hillshire Farms or Hickory Farms summer sausage that
okay.
you get at the store. But this, I added a little bit of whole mustard seed in there, so it gives it a little bit of a texture difference. So you kind of get this little pop when you're eating it. So most people really like it.
Well, as a guy that likes to spend a lot of time not only on that stove but in front of the Weber Grill outside smoking meat, really look forward to it. So Zach Reed, we're going to be talking about meat, food, the science of food today. Really appreciate your time. Thanks for coming out. How do you get into food science is what we'll get to. But first of all, you started telling me a little bit about where that summer sausage came from. What is it that you do now?
Okay, currently I work for an ingredient company called Ingredion. So the main thing that I work that we deal with is starches. So here there used to be a company called Penford Starches selling potato starches that our friend Ann worked for. And then Ingredion purchased them. So anyways, I'm doing all the research and understanding how to add these starches in there for further processed meats. So you're looking at your lunch meats and all the food service meats and different things like that. So we add starch in there to make it juicier, to help the water in there, make it tastier. And, you know, there's a lot more science behind food than I think a lot of people realize. So
there's a lot more science around everything that,
yes.
that we're really, and I'm already realizing that just three episodes into Piled High and Deep here. So let's start from the beginning. You told me you grew up in Utah,
yep.
Big family. Tell me about growing up as a kid. Where was that? And
so I was born in Bountiful, Utah, just north of Salt Lake. And then when I three or four, we moved up to northern Utah, up to Cache Valley area there, where Utah State is, mm-hmm. and Logan. And so I've got three brothers and three sisters. So I'm the number three out of seven.
Okay.
And so for me growing up, I always loved to cook. So I've got, like I say, I've got three sisters, but I did more cooking in the house than any of my sisters because I loved to cook. Always loved science. And I just spent a lot of time cooking when I'd go on scouting trips. I was always volunteering to cook, and the other guys liked it when I did that as well, too. So, I just kind of grew up cooking. And,
what'd your folks do?
So my dad was a general contractor for a number of years, and until he hurt his back, actually lifting up a wall on my third birthday.
Okay.
So ruptured some disc in his back, and that's when we moved to Cache Valley, and he started his own company. So he was selling wood-burning stoves pellet stoves. So he designed and created his own the Forge wood-burning stoves everything. So, and my mom for most of my life was a stay-at-home mom with all of us kids, and then once we got older, then she went to become an aide at the school, so she worked with blind children. Okay. She still does.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Hey, speaking of the wood stove, I grew up in Durango, Colorado, southwest up in the mountains of southwest of Denver and southwest Colorado, and am very familiar with wood stoves as we had two of them in our house.
Yeah.
So much of the summer in our house was spent cutting firewood, splitting that firewood, stacking it, in preparation for the winter months.
For the winter time, yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, we actually didn't have a wood-burning stove in our house. We ended up having pellet stoves most of the time. And so when I worked for my dad, I got to help deliver the 40-pound bags of pellets to people's houses and stuff. So
did he do the manufacturing of the wood stoves?
Yeah, so he designed them and manufactured them for a number of years. And then so after a while, he stopped manufacturing the pellet stoves and then just really went to gas fireplaces and selling and installing all of those.
Right.
So, and then for a while was selling redwood swing sets. So when I was working for him, I helped install those and different things.
So what was the emphasis of education in your home?
It's interesting,
Out of seven kids, how many went to college?
So now there's three of us with college degrees.
Okay.
So I've got my PhD. My younger brother has a business degree, and then my youngest sister just finished her degree to become a teacher.
Okay.
So education degree. So my grandpa Reed, who's passed away now, has a PhD in pharmacology, and he was actually the head of the pharmacology department at the University of Utah for a number of years. But growing up, I was all, one of seven kids trying to get good grades. I didn't like school that much, like doing all the homework.
Right.
I could have got better grades if I'd applied myself a little bit more, but it wasn't college. If I wanted to go, that was great. But there were other options if I didn't want to go to college as well. So, talking with my dad, he always said it wasn't that college degree that was going to make the life. It's the hard work that you put in.
Right.
So, I wanted to go to school. I loved science. And so that's kind of where I gravitated toward chemistry to begin with.
Were you a good high school student?
No.
No.
No. No. I wasn't, only because I just didn't apply myself. I mean, I could get by really well with just listening and not doing any studying, which isn't the best thing. And so I'm trying to help my son not have those habits. But, sometimes you say you get a kid just like you, and my son's a lot like me in that way. So I see him, and I see the frustration that my parents had with me coming home to roost again. So it's kind of interesting. But, I mean, I did really well. I did all right. And if I would have done a little bit more, I could have had straight A's. But I've done all right.
Right. Yeah. And so that's one of the things I like to talk about, and, in Piled High and Deep, is that it doesn't – to attain that PhD, you don't need to be the best and brightest student coming out of high school. It's about applying yourself and finding that passion.
Yeah, exactly. So even in my undergraduate degree, I remember talking to another student, and we were talking about grades, and I think my overall GPA was 3.2 or something like that. And she said that, no, I'd get kicked out of my education program if my grades were that low. And I said, well, chemistry is a bit more difficult to area there. And so that's what I found, is that once I found my passion, that, you know, the grades in grad school definitely came up, because I got to spend more time on that. Wasn't working full time like I was during the undergrad time, and it was just something that I was really passionate about, so made a big difference.
I think you said you had an undergrad degree in chemistry.
Correct.
From Utah State?
Yep. Yep.
How did you find Utah State? Was it the closest place?
It was. They accepted me, and they were close.
Right.
So I grew up, you know, 15 minutes away from the campus, was doing stuff up on Utah State campus all the time. They had a really good chemistry program, and, you know, it was close to home. I could live at home and go to school. Although I was married by the time I got into school. So, overall, it just was a great place to go, and, something I was familiar with and not too expensive.
Did you go to college right out of high school, or did you take some time off?
No. So when I graduated from high school in 1995, I just turned 18, and being born and raised in Utah, I'm Mormon. And so when I was 19, I served a mission for 2 years in Costa Rica.
Okay.
So graduated from high school. I actually started going to Utah State, went to one quarter of classes, and then worked to save up some money. And then in September of 96, I went to Costa Rica to serve a mission there for 2 years. So, well, I went to Provo, learned Spanish. They gave me
right.
eight weeks to learn Spanish, and then sent me on a plane to Costa Rica. So...
how is your Espanol these days?
Todavía está bien.
Okay.
So yeah, I've, my last job in Kansas, my coworker was from Mexico. So I would say probably about 75% of our conversations were in Spanish.
Nice. Okay.
So I still get to practice. I have an uncle who's Venezuelan, an aunt who's Peruvian, who's
okay.
married into the family. So my cousin speaks Spanish. So lots of opportunity to continue to speak Spanish.
So, after the mission, off to college?
Almost. So, you know, I was in Costa Rica, as a missionary there. I was a gringo in a foreign country. And so oftentimes as we were living there, in Costa Rica, you know, we weren't always necessarily feeling the best, you know,
right.
eating the local foods and different things like that. And so, I was just kind of sick and tired for about the last year that I was there. I just figured it was part of being in Costa Rica. But then I got home in September of 98, and I was still sick and tired for the next few months. And then finally had gone to the doctors, had some tests done, and in February of 99 found out that I had Hodgkin's lymphoma. So found out I had cancer, and started to do chemotherapy treatments and radiation therapy treatments. So 99... was not the best year, other than the fact that's the year that I met my wife.
Okay.
So that was the best thing that happened to me in 99.
Talk of coincidence. So at age 20, right?
21. Yeah.
That's considered a childhood cancer.
Okay.
At that time, I think, at least from what I've read, my son and I are part of the St. Baldrick's Foundation. We actually just shaved our heads yesterday as we're recording this. It's March 11th, 2017. And yesterday in Denver for us was St. Baldrick's Day. And the St. Baldrick's Foundation, a large foundation solely focused on the fight against childhood cancer. So you go, you're entering college. Had you held off? Were you going to college and undergoing your treatment at the same time?
So, so I got back, like I say, in September of 98, and I started the treatments in February of 99, and I talked to the doctor, and I said, you know, I'd been wanting to go to school, and he suggested that I might want to hold off until I was done with all the treatments and everything that I was going to need to go through. So I didn't actually start. I started winter semester in 2000 is when I actually finally got back to school. So I was a little older than some of the students there, you know, in Utah, with a lot of guys going on mission and coming back and not starting school till they're 21. It sometimes is a little bit older anyways, but I was in another year older, so I started school really in 2000.
Okay, alrighty. How well did the transition then? Because you, by that time, you'd been 3 years since high school.
Yeah.
How did those early college years go for you?
Again, I was still not having the best study habits, and I got married in 2000, and so I was working 30, 40 hours a week, plus trying to go to school full time, so my grades weren't always the best. So it was a tough time, and chemistry was a tough major, especially a lot of those beginning classes, general chemistry, organic chemistry, that they use for a lot of weeder classes for people who think they want to go become a doctor.
Right.
And so a lot of those classes, you know, the physics and all that were tough. And so, you know, I did all right. I loved the classes, loved lecture, loved learning, hate homework.
Well,
I don't know that anybody that loves homework. So I could go to lectures and listen and ask questions, you know, all day long, just curious about how things work and why. I made it through there, put in a lot of hours at work and put in a lot of hours in the lab and got everything done.
At that point, did you have an idea of what you wanted to do?
So when I started out, you know, the plan was to get my bachelor's degree in chemistry and then go on and go to grad school and get a PhD in biochemistry because that's what I really enjoyed. And then in 2003, I went to the University of Arkansas for an internship for 10 weeks. They had an REU program, research experience for undergraduates. So I went to the University of Arkansas and worked with Dr. Joshua Sakon there in his biochemistry lab, doing x-ray crystallography. And after that 10 weeks, when I came home, you know, because my wife had just finished her medical assisting degree and had just started a new job, so she stayed in Utah while I went to Arkansas. When I got home, I looked at her and said, you know, I don't think I want to be a biochemist anymore. And so at that point, I was a junior getting close to being done. She's like, all right, well, what do you want to do? And we happened to be watching a TV show called Good Eats with Alton Brown.
Right,
don't know
yeah,
if you've ever
yep,
seen it.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a food scientist come on the TV show, and she was talking about the crystal structure of fudge when you're making fudge and how to make it so that it's not grainy and all that. Well, she was talking about a bunch of the sugar crystals, and it just so happened that I was studying those sugars in my organic chemistry class. And, you know, my wife had mentioned and said something, well, what about food science? And I said, oh, what is food science? And so I started looking into it a little bit more. And there on campus at Utah State, like a lot of universities, we had a place called Aggie Ice Cream where they sold cheese and ice cream in the department there. Well, doing a little bit more research, I found out that there was a whole department behind Aggie Ice Cream there, the food science department. And so I ended up taking a food science class there, and it ended up, you know, being a great thing because it was a perfect mix for my passion for cooking, which I've always had, and my passion for chemistry, because I really did love chemistry, but the way that I would be able to apply it in food science, you know, was something that was exciting to me. So that's kind of how I started on that path into food science.
Well, that's, it's amazing how the universe kind of just provides the path that you ultimately want to follow here. Let's my daughter, who's just starting out in college, happened to go to Utah State a couple of months ago.
Oh, right.
for some school thing that she's a part of, and she came back talking about the Aggie ice cream that she had on campus at Utah State.
Yeah. Yeah, so yeah, there's a whole department behind all the food there. So
what at some point or in that Utah State experience that you had, did you have any professors or educators that really helped guide you and mentored you at some point in this?
So in the chemistry department, I was working in the lab of Dr. Enzyme there and was doing some enzyme work and different things. And so he was helping out with the chemistry. But once I found food science, the food science class that I took, I had Dr. Marie Walsh there. She kind of opened my eyes to what food science was and what the possibilities were. And so that's actually how I got my introduction to Oregon State University, where I ended up getting my PhD at. She said that she knew, you know, a couple professors up there and thought that it would be a good program. And, you know, and I told her about my background, so we got to know each other. And so she was really helpful in kind of guiding me into, you know, what the possibilities were in the world of food science and where I could go, and that really my chemistry background would be a really beneficial thing in food science. So with her encouragement, on a Sunday afternoon, I emailed, I think, every professor in the food science department at Oregon State to see if any of them had any openings or anything going on. And so I got a couple of responses back from some of them saying, no, they didn't have anything. And then I got a response back from Dr. Jay Park, who ended up being my major professor, saying that, hey, he was interested in talking to me. And then he got back to me a couple of days later and said, did you email everybody in the department? I think he thought he was a little more special there. And I said, well, I did, but,
don't take it personally. That's where I want to go. I'm going to talk to everybody about that.
Exactly. So, after I got back with him, he wanted to have a phone interview. We talked, and he seemed really interested. He liked the fact that I was a little bit older than his average student that was coming in there.
Because by that time you're 25, 26.
Yeah, exactly. And at that time, you know, I had a 10-month-old son, and so I was married. I had a son, a bit more stable, and you know, I think he was seeing the upside of some maturity levels there coming into grad school.
Little did he know.
Exactly. So anyways, yeah, we interviewed over the phone. He thought I sounded great. And then he said, all right, well, why don't you, I'll fly you up here so we can do an in-person interview. And so he flew me up there during his, annual Surimi school. So for those who don't know, Surimi is the stuff that they use to make imitation crab meat, which we don't call imitation anymore. It's just a fish-based protein product.
Right. Yeah.
There.
Which is, we'll get to that. Cause, as part of Piled High and Deep, the podcast, I do ask for the dissertation, and not that I'm going to understand, you know, a lick of it, but I do want to get a sense as to what it is that ultimately led to the path and what the output was. Let's back up just a little bit, though. As you're finishing up at Utah State, you've got this family. This new family, you said, a 10-month-old, a wife that's working and is probably taking a look at going, you know, I have to go where? You know, we're going where? How are we going to do this? What was the game plan there?
Hope and pray for the best was the game plan. Luckily, my wife was actually born and raised in Beaverton, Oregon. And so she still had family in Oregon. So she was excited about the prospects of being able to go back to Oregon. Now at that time, her parents actually lived there in Logan where we did. So her parents weren't there. None of her siblings were, but she had cousins. And like I say, she was born and raised until she was 16 there before she moved to American Samoa. And so she was excited about the prospect of moving up there and the opportunities that we had. So that wasn't too scary. And once Jackson, our son, was born, she ended up being a stay-at-home mom to take care of him. Because when we ran the financials to see how much she would be making versus child care, it's like, all right, well, we're not making enough extra to make it worth it for you not to be home with our son. So she ended up staying at home while I was going to school.
Oh, that worked out beautifully. How long did your PhD program go? And did you do the master's in between, or did you just go straight from bachelor's to PhD?
So I actually went from my bachelor's to Oregon State for a master's degree. And so that was the plan, was to go there and to get a master's degree. And the way that the seafood lab where Dr. Park was located, he was located in Astoria, Oregon, where they filmed Goonies.
Great
movie. Got to go see the Goonies house while we were there. But the seafood lab was in Astoria, Oregon, and the campus is in Corvallis, so about 3 hours south of there. So when I went to school, I went and did three quarters of classes. So I did all my classes, you know, in a row without doing any research at all. And then we moved from Corvallis to Astoria, where I did all of my research. And so, like I say, the plan was to get a master's degree. Well, after about a year of working on everything for the master's degree and coming up with a lot of the research that I had, first off, I came home and I was telling my wife about all the other students who were working towards a master's. It's going to take about 2, maybe 3 years. And then they were starting to look at PhD programs and everything. And so she said, no, you're not going to get a PhD, right? You're done. We're going to go get a job and we're going to move on with life. And I said, hon, I promise I don't want to get a PhD. We're done. I'm ready to go. Fast forward 2 weeks and I come home from work and tell Aaron that Dr. Park talked to me today and he thinks the research that I'm doing is more suited towards a PhD program than a master's program. So he wants me to publish my first journal article and petition to the school to go directly into the PhD program. And so after a bit of discussion, she was on board with it.
Right.
But so it had been the plan just to get a master's and then be done. But like I say, the research that I was doing, Dr. Park, I don't know that he necessarily thought, as I look back on it now, I don't know that he necessarily thought the research was more suited to the PhD program as much as it was he thought I was more suited to the PhD program, that I think he saw something in me that I could do it, that I was somebody that he could push and mentor and help through. So he convinced me to do that. So I published my first paper, petitioned the school, and then changed over into the PhD program. So no master's degree, just a PhD.
What was that first publication?
So that one was using a technique called SDS page in identifying the fish species in crab sticks. So the imitation crab meat, when you get it, it's made from different kinds of fish. And on the label, it will say most here in the U.S. is made from Alaska pollock. But once you've made it into the crab stick, you don't have the fish anymore to see. So there are some countries that will say that it's Alaska pollock when it's not. So I was working on some identification methods to be able to prove what kind of fish was in there and how much fish was in there. So with that first publication, we got that published in the Journal of Food Science.
So let's talk about in the last episode that we had with Sean Rourke, he was working in with a lot of enzymes and doing a little bit of genetic work in there as well. I'm guessing that when you're trying to identify the different species of fish that's in a produced crab stick, Are you looking at the genetic material within that? Are you looking at enzymes? What are you doing? What's the process there?
So we were looking specifically at the proteins. So the proteins we were looking at, Cerami, really the definition of it is purified myofibrillar protein. And so the myofibrillar protein is really the fibers that you see when you look at the muscle, which is what gives you the contraction. And so that's what gives you the gelling ability in meat and what we use in processed meat, but what we use in surimi. So in these proteins, there's all sorts of different proteins that go into that to make up the whole structure of it. And so when we do some heating and some denaturation process, we break those down into the individual proteins. And so what the SDS page does is when you run that through, it will give you some bands based on the molecular weight of those proteins. So if you've ever watched any crime show and they show a DNA where you've got all the bands on there, that's for DNA. So there's some similar techniques for SDS page. So you're really looking at the different molecular weights. And when you're looking at that, there are specific myosin light chains for individual species that are going to be species specific.
Okay.
And so that's what we were looking at, is really creating that fingerprint of those proteins to be able to determine what species was in there, and then quantify how much of it was used in the actual crab stick.
So you're able to identify the species of fish by looking at the different proteins rather than having to do a genetic test.
Yeah. So now the only issue is that because some of the proteins are so close that the resolution sometimes was a little bit difficult to get that. So the first couple studies were looking at using SDS page on there to identify them. And then we decided, you know, we needed to get a little bit more specific. So we looked at ELISA assay. So that uses an antibody that, just like we have in our bodies, that react when something comes in, it recognizes that as foreign object that needs to be destroyed. Well, you can have antibodies created specifically that can detect certain portions of a protein. And so that's what we ended up doing, is having some monoclonal antibodies created to be specific for this one protein from this one specific fish. And what we found is that when we had that one fish in there, we could quantify and estimate how much of that fish was actually in the product very well. The only issue was that we had a lot of cross-reactivity. And so what it did is that even though it was specific to that protein, there's only a section of that protein that it recognized. But that section also happened to be in chicken and beef and other things. So it detected all of these other things. So we could, if we mixed it together, we couldn't, the quantification kind of broke down on there.
Okay. I'm a big fan of acronyms here. So what is SDS page? What is the...
That stands for sodium dodecyl sulfate polyacrylamide gel electrophoresis.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Which is why we call it SDS page.
SDS page, right. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. So I don't necessarily want to get in the weeds here, but I want to get a better understanding as to the work that you did to get to the dissertation, which is the immunological and physicochemical characterization of fish myosins.
Mm-hmm.
So the only word that really makes sense to me is myosins. That's talking about the muscle protein.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what are you taking a look? I think you just ran me through that,
mm-hmm.
But how do you get to this process? What all are you doing? Are you taking apart? Are you making your own fish sticks? Are you buying buying the crab sticks at the grocery store? Are you testing those as well? What are you doing in this?
So, you know, Dr. Park is his nickname. He's also known as the Surimi Man. So all of the Surimi crab stick work that I did, we would get surimi from the typical surimi producers, and you know, that would be used in the commercial crab stick. So anything that you could buy at the store, we would get that base material, and then I'd make my own crab sticks with different amounts so that we could make a gradient so we could understand how much was added in now, there.
Hang on here just a second. You're a mountain kid from Utah.
Uh-huh.
My guess is that up until you ended up in Astoria, Oregon, the closest thing you came to a fish was either a rainbow or a brown trout that you probably pulled out of the lake down the road or one of the number of rivers that's flowing through Utah. You don't grab me as really a fish guy.
No, no. Yeah. So really all my experience like had actually been with fly fishing and high mountain fishing in Wyoming for scout camps and different things. So rainbows and brookies and brown trout and all that stuff. So yeah, going to Astoria and starting to work with Alaska pollock and more with salmon and different things like that. It was a little bit different.
Right. I mean, I'm sure you can pan fry a trout like nobody else.
Oh yeah. And even with grad school, I got really good with a fillet knife, because as you were saying for processing. So as the long confusing title of my dissertation, talks about the immunochemical was the portion where I was talking about the ELISA assays where we created antibodies there. That was the immunological portion of the testing. And so I have six different chapters in my dissertation, which ended up being six different published papers in journal articles. And so that's kind of the way that our program worked, which made it easy because by the time I had the article published, my graduate committee couldn't really argue much because it had gone through the peer review process. So I had a couple of papers that were looking at the detection. So we were looking at the immunological, trying to understand the quantification there. The SDS page was some of the chemical there, looking at trying to quantify. And then things kind of shifted gears and went to the physiochemical aspects. And that was really a lot of the myosin work. So I did myosin work with king salmon and tilapia. And like you say, the myosin, that muscle fiber is really what gives you the cohesive texture when you're cooking. So when you're making surimi, we have that purified myofibrillar protein to give you the kind of rubbery texture you're looking at. And so what we were trying to understand is how these different myosins performed. And so I had a bunch of different testings that I would do. So doing some dynamic rheology where we'd put it between a couple plates and it would rotate back and forth to see how viscoelastic it was. So to see how much rubberiness it would get as we heated up. And so my wife's eyes kind of glass over as I get excited and start talking about stuff.
It's wonderful. I love, you know, one of the things I love about talking to PhDs, and the reason I started this podcast is that people somebody finds something that just jazzes them up so much that they can talk about it all day, even while their spouse's eyes gloss over. And in my wildest dreams, I would never have thought that I would be an insurance geek.
Yep.
And I have friends of mine, we love talking about insurance stuff. It'll make anybody else's eyes gloss right over. But in this case, you know, for you, finding, that's the path that I'm talking about. You find somebody that sees in you what it is that they have a passion for, and they can share that. And even if it's something as, you know, surprise, you know, I love the fish flakes. I get, you know, I go to King Supers and I get the Cajun flavored, faux crab dip. That's exactly what we're talking about.
Yep, exactly.
That you're messing with. So what was the end result of the work that you did other than turning it into a dissertation? What has been what's that been used for now? Is it used as a quality identification tool? In finished product that's either being produced here domestically or is being imported?
So that was really kind of the ultimate gold star goal was to be able to do that, because what I think a lot of people don't realize, when it comes to food, there are so many standards of identity that you have to meet for different foods. With crab sticks, there's not a standard of identity for what is contained in there. So, you know, being adulterated with having a different kind of fish than what's listed on there, or having extremely high levels of starch and lower amounts of fish protein on there, you know, there wasn't any regulation on that. Whereas in hot dogs and breakfast sausage and all of these different things, there's very specific standards that you have to meet. And if you don't meet them, then you have to call them other, you know, imitation, or you know, have different names on there that you can't call them. So that's what we were trying to do, was trying to determine a standard of identity. Unfortunately, with everything, we were able to get a number of papers, and we were able to show that we could do things under limited circumstances. We could identify and quantify that.
Now, hang on a second. When you're talking about the quantification, so if you have a pound of crab stick here,
mm-hmm.
was your methodology, were the results of your methodology able to determine that 60% of this was pollock, 30% of it was another protein source that maybe wasn't necessarily a fish-based protein source?
Yeah, that's exactly what we were trying to do. And so as I was creating all of the data and the research for that, I would make crab sticks that would have, you know, 40, 50, 60% on there, so I could create a line and get an equation so that we could estimate an unknown amount, you know, of that. And then we also had, looking at the SDS page, we could see if they had soy protein isolate added in there, or dry egg whites, other protein sources in there. In the end, I think one of the things, you know, we were doing that, we had some success, but I think the overall crab stick market wasn't big enough to justify all that would really need to go in there to be able to do that. And, you know, nobody was really pushing for, other than my professor, really pushing for a standard of identity to really include a lot of high quality surimi protein in there. So we were able to get some good results, but then, like I say, when you started mixing things together, it became a more complicated system. And I think that's the other thing that a lot of people don't realize is, you know, they think creating drugs and, you know, pharmaceuticals and all these things are difficult. But in those situations, you're working with very pure substances, very small amounts of these different substances, trying to understand them. Whereas in food, we're working with, especially in meat, we're working with meat that comes from live animals. And so we don't always have the exact same thing. It can vary from animal to animal. So it makes it sometimes like a moving target to try and get everything to fall into place and work. So it's a lot more complicated than I think a lot of people realize.
When did you finish up with the dissertation?
So I had my final defense on December 2nd of 2010.
Okay.
So went in there and passed that. So at that point, like I say, at that point, I think five of my six papers had been published in peer-reviewed journal articles that made up all the chapters of my dissertation, and the other one was in review at that time. So really, it was more of a formality than anything to go through there.
In your dissertation process, there's lab work and there's writing. How do you like writing?
Not so much. Not as much. I'm much more a hands-on in the lab kind of guy. And when I did my writing, I had to usually do that early in the morning or during the day, because after 5 or 6 o'clock at night, it just kind of got rambling and didn't make any. I would write something a couple of times at 8 or 9 o'clock at night, and read it the next morning, and it didn't make any sense at all.
Okay, so writing is not really one of the things that you liked about about the dissertation process.
No, not necessarily. I really enjoy the planning and the execution of the research, coming up with the best way to get all of the information that I'm going to need, but then writing that down in a very easy to communicate way is a lot more difficult. You know, I remember spending an hour, 2 hours writing one sentence so that by the time you read it, it made sense at the end. And so that wasn't my favorite part.
Right.
By the end, I'm much better at it now. And, you know, with Dr. Park's help, you know, I've gotten pretty good at it, but still not necessarily my favorite thing to do.
So as you make the decision to get the PhD, what did you envision doing after the PhD? Did you think you'd be going into academia? Did you ever have that thought in your head, or did you always think that you would be going into the private sector?
So when I started the PhD program, you know, the interesting thing about Dr. Park is he's Korean. And he's probably about 5'5", 5'6", and I'm 6'2". The first time I ever met him, I walked up to him and said, "Hi, Dr. Park, I'm Zach." When I went up for the interview, the first thing he said to me is, "Wow, you're a big guy." All right. But even for his size, he can be a very intimidating man.
Right.
So his idea still is for me to go into academia. He wanted me to go into academia. He thought it suited my personality. He saw me working with other students, and felt that I had a knack for teaching and working with students. So
did you teach as part of your PhD program?
So I didn't have to teach. TA'd a lab course, so I taught the lab course and ran that. But other than that, I didn't have to have to do any real teaching. Other than, you know, when we'd get new students in, I'd run them through teaching them how to do SDS page and a number of things as I got to be a more senior student there in the lab. But, you know, so Dr. Park really wanted me to go into academia, and so as I was getting closer, I had put in an application for a position as a professor at the University of Florida, which I wasn't really excited about going to Florida. heat and humidity aren't
right.
My friends. So I was I had put in my application there, and then I had put in an application and ended up getting interviews at Kraft, Oscar Mayer, and also for ConAgra Foods. And academia is notoriously slow
right.
in hiring people. So I had finished school. I was doing interviews. Dr. Park gave me a 3-month postdoc support so that I could continue doing some research and having some money
right.
while I was looking for a job. And, you know, that's when Oscar Mayer offered me a job. And, you know, before I accepted it, I contacted the University of Florida because I was interested in it, but they had something change, and so they were re-changing the date, and so it was going to be another 6 months before they even had a decision on there. So at that point, I'm like, all right, I've been in school for a long time now. I need to get a job.
Right.
And so I took the job at Oscar Mayer. So I went from fish to
hot dogs.
To hot dogs, exactly.
How did you like Madison? It's Madison, isn't
it? Madison, Wisconsin. It was interesting coming from Utah and then from Oregon. It was an interesting place. I do remember asking during my interviews what Madison was like, and you know, I interviewed with like 8 to 10 people in smaller groups throughout the day, and one person in every group referred to Madison as the Berkeley of the Midwest. So it was a very liberal area. So that was a little different for me
right.
from what I had grown up with. But I enjoyed the area. I made some really good lifelong friends there. And
walleye and cheese.
Yeah, I had to learn. There wasn't a lot of trout fly
right,
fishing
yeah.
like I had grown up with. So I was I never got into the fishing. I tried, but the bass fishing and all that just didn't excite me like the mountain streams.
Right, and I'm sorry. I have I work for a company that's based out of Minnesota. I have zero interest in going out on a January morning to go fishing.
We went ice fishing once while I was in Madison. Didn't catch anything, and it was once.
Right.
So.
Yeah. Now I'll tell you that fried walleye nuggets. Those are some tasty vittles right there, along with a side of cheese curds.
Yeah.
But no, I'm still not going out to go fishing on ice. So what did you do at Kraft?
So at Kraft at Oscar Mayer there.
Oscar
I was
Mayer.
Yeah I was so. With all the food companies these days, one big company owns all the other
ones.
So anyways, with Kraft Oscar Mayer, I was in the meat science research group. And so in our group at the time, it was six PhDs that we did a lot of the basic research on the meat science and different things. So there were product developers who were developing the new flavors of turkey and hot dogs and all those different things. And we were doing a lot more of the research behind some of that stuff. So some of the research that I did was looking at the differences between using sodium nitrite and celery powder to cure hot dogs, to look at the color stability on there, because a lot of people don't like nitrite in their hot dogs, and so they buy their uncured hot dogs that have celery powder or celery juice in there that end up having the same amount of nitrite in there to give them the cured color and flavor. So
how well does taking a look at fish in surimi, how well does that translate over to working with beef and pork products?
So that was a question I got from every one of the interviews. As you've spent the last 5 years looking at fish,
right?
Why do you want to go to red meat? And my first answer was, well, I need a job.
Right.
And my second answer was, it's all protein chemistry is what it ends up being. So there are some subtle differences in the amount of connective tissue between, land animals like beef and fish. But in the end, what we're looking for in meat and in fish is we're looking for that myosin, that myofibrillar protein, because that's what we need to extract and hold the products together. So in the end, it's all protein chemistry, whether it comes from a cow or whether it comes from a fish. So with my chemistry background and then all the protein chemistry background of the fish, it easily translated over to beef, pork, and chicken and all that.
Interesting. What's your day? Okay, let's continue down the line, and then we'll get to your everyday here. So you went to Oscar Mayer. You had a couple of cups of coffee with them. How long were you there?
I was there for a full day. For the job.
How long were you there on the job?
Almost 3 years.
Okay.
Yeah. So I was there for almost 3 years, and then after that, moved to Kansas, where I was leading the meat lab and all the meat research for a company called Corbion there. They do a lot of the food safety ingredients.
Okay.
So, when you hear about all the food products that are getting recalled for Listeria and different things, our company was making the products so that you didn't get Listeria and to control all of that.
Okay.
So I was there for about 2.5 years, and then now I'm here in Colorado for about 7 months now.
Okay. Compare what you're doing now with what you did in Kansas. I know that there have been, just because of my job, on the insurance side of food insurance and that type of stuff, I know that there have been some changes by the federal government and the FDA specifically recently in the last couple of years in terms of food products and wanting to make sure that food production is safe. They've changed some rules about what's called ready to eat, need to cook, lots of kill step issues. Won't bore folks with that, but that's what you were doing in Kansas. How is that different? But as you're here in Colorado at Ingredion, you're more looking at the the food production side and building quality food products that way?
So we're an ingredient company.
Okay.
And so our ingredients, we will sell to all the different food companies. So all the big meat processors, meat companies,
right,
will buy our ingredients. And then, you know, a lot of the smaller ones will as well. And so one of the things that's going on is clean label issues. And so when we talk about clean label issues in food, a lot of people don't like to read the ingredient statement and see a lot of the eights on there, see phosphates and nitrate, right, and all of these different things on there, things that they don't recognize and don't realize how important they are to functionalize and make the products the way that they are and work the way that they are and make them safe. So, you know, we've got the traditional things. A lot of the things that we do, like I say, are starches. So we've got modified food starches. Well, people see modified on there and are, well, what's going on? Well, it's just some processing that goes on to make them function better, to so that when you get your package of hot dogs, you don't have as much purge or the liquid in the package of the hot dogs. It stays in the hot dog to keep it juicier. But we also have our clean label where we don't modify the starches, where we just use native starches. And so a lot of what I do now is working with the companies to try and take out phosphate and take out these other ingredients that the consumer doesn't want in there, but they still want a good product. They still want it to be moist. They still want it to be tender. They still want it to last, you know, for 6 months in their refrigerator. Right. So, you know, we've got some challenges that we work on. So now versus the, so I don't work on the food safety as like I did
like
at Corbion,
did before,
like
right.
I did with Corbion. Now it's really on the functionality of the products and clean labels. So, you know, and some of the work that I've been recently doing has been making, like I say, a bunch of different hot dogs formulations with a number of our different starch ingredients to see which ones give us the best texture, which ones give us the best cook yield, which ones give us the least amount of purge, so the least amount of water that comes out in the package and everything, which people don't need to worry about. It's just water that isn't held on in the meat there. It's all fine. But, you know, so that's a lot of what I get to do. And then, you know, working with customers, going out and visiting the end users of the product and help them with their product. So I get to work with our tech service team a lot to help people out, help different companies out with the issues that they're having in their processing and how we can help them remove phosphate or make a clean label or make it so that it has freeze thaw stability. Cause you get meats and you get it in a Hungry Man dinner or something. You want to make sure that once it's frozen and then thawed, all that water just doesn't come out and you get a pool of water on your plate there. So we'll add starches in there because that helps us with freeze thaw stability and different things.
So the starch is added then into a ground meat that's frozen, and the starch is then used to keep that water in place.
So yeah, when it cooks up, you know, so when you use starches, you know, like cornstarch to make gravy or something like that, and you cook it and it thickens up, that's what we're doing. We'll add that to meat. So we can add it to ground meats. We can inject it into whole cuts of meat so that it's more tender. We can vacuum tumble that in. So we will just add basically a marinade with the starch and the salt and different things and put that in a vacuum tumbler and spin it around. And that will pick up, you know, the marination there and that will help with the cook yield and the moisture and everything in the meat. So lots of different things that we can do. And, you know, I think a lot of people, you know, we do a lot of things with food service. So restaurants and companies that do that kind of thing. And people are always wondering, well, how come this chicken breast from a restaurant or something like that is always so tender and juicy? Well, it's because it's been vacuum tumbled and has some added water and salt and starches in there to keep it in there that you don't necessarily do at home. And so, you know, that's one of our big areas that we work with food service is that, you know, there's a lot of manipulations that you can do that just make it better. So when I make turkey for Thanksgiving, I brine our turkey for a couple of days,
right.
Just to keep it more moist. We never end up having enough drippings to make gravy because all the moisture stayed in the turkey. So it's just all a matter of knowing how to manipulate those different things. And I think that's where it comes down to a lot of consumers are concerned about what that means, what's being done to it. So,
right. One of the things about Piled High and Deep that I want to spend a little time with when I'm talking to folks is your use of, you know, especially when I'm talking to scientists, your use of math every day. as a chemist, and I vaguely remember those chemistry courses that I struggled through in college, and ultimately that's why I got a history degree. But you know, there was a lot of math there. Did you go up through the calculus route, and you did all that, and it translates into chemistry, and then using that as you're building data analytics tools, et cetera?
Yeah, so math is, you know, as much as I hate to admit my teachers always saying that you're going to use math all the time, they're right. Basically, my life is one big story problem, right, after another. Is, you know, calculating the amounts that we have to add in there. Again, like I say, with regulations, we have standards of identity of different meats and different things that you can do. So you can add starch in, but sometimes only at certain levels. And that level depends on whether it's raw or whether it's cooked. And so when you've got a cook yield and lost some weight, how much do you still have left in there, and meeting all of these regulations? So, you know, as I've been helping my son Jackson with his math homework, I brought home one day a notebook that I have at work that is written on the front of it called calculations, that I put a date on it as I'm working through all the calculations that I have to do. So there's a lot more math, involved. Like I say, I have to do that all the time. I use a lot of software to help with statistics when I'm running that on the experiments that I've run. My wife likes to say I'm a bit nerdy, and I like Excel too much.
Right,
but
yeah.
I do. I love Excel. So,
just give me a pivot table. It just makes my day.
Yeah, exactly. Anytime I can throw the data in there and start manipulating it, looking around at it.
Dashboard,
my heart. Yeah, so... yeah, but I use a lot of math all the time. I wish I would have worked a little harder in my earlier days to understand
it.
I think it would have made life a lot easier. And so that's one of the things I try to pass on to Jackson is do it now.
Do it now, right. Yeah.
Do it now.
Again, though, we can only lead them to the water.
Yeah, exactly.
We can't make them drink. What would 18-year-old Zach think of 40-year-old Zach? Am I right on the about 40?
In June, yeah.
In
June, I'll be 40. You know, he wouldn't have known that he was going to be here.
Right.
The path that I took here.
Did 18-year-old Zach know what he wanted?
Chemistry is what I at that time, that's what I thought, and that's what I knew that I wanted to do was chemistry. And then, you know, as we've talked about, it kind of veered off and changed to food science and ended up bringing that all together. But really my idea was to go into chemistry or to become a chef. And after finishing school and a number of years, I really enjoy the work that I get to do and the people that I get to work with in the industry that I'm in.
And you have better hours than being a chef.
I have better hours than being a chef. But there are days when I think back, if I knew what I know now, it might be a little bit more harder decision not to end up going to be a chef, because I do love to cook. And, you know, even talking with my wife, I've thought about at some point, you know, it would be fun to do a food truck or do something at some point in time. You know, as you saw, I brought you the summer sausage today in Kansas. I had to get rid of it when we moved here, but in Kansas, I had an old refrigerator I got off of Craigslist that I had in the basement that I used to dry cure my own meat. So I dry cure salamis and pepperonis and all sorts of stuff at home and share that with friends. And you know, I love to cook and I love to share that food with people. So food science has been great because it's given me a passion where I get to do a lot of some of the artistry of food with meat. But then I also get the scientific excitement and curiosity. I get to scratch that itch in food science. So I think he'd be all right. 18-year-old Zach would be all right with where he's at. He may say, "How did you end up there?" And I wouldn't have a real
right.
answer.
So. Right. On a daily basis, what do you bring? What you learned, you use every day.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's like I say, it's a lot of problem solving all the time. And, you know, the more experience that I have, the more that it helps me every day to be able to answer those questions and to troubleshoot the issues that we have. So, you know, everything that I've learned just keeps getting built upon and learning new things and applying those and helping other people. I do get the opportunity to train people within the company about meat science, you know, sales groups and different things is there so that they can understand when it comes to meat and they're going out and talking with the customer so they can talk about that with the customers. So I kind of get to scratch a little bit of that itch for academia because I do enjoy teaching and sharing that knowledge and seeing people understand things once I've explained. So I really do like that. So I get a little bit of that in what I do now as well.
Do you still publish at all?
It's been a couple of years. Dr. Park still wants me to go into academia.
So the relationship is held strong.
Oh yes. Yeah. Actually I will be, in May, I'm going up to Astoria where I'll be teaching the protein chemistry portion of his Surimi school that he does every year. So oh, wow. I believe this is his 25th, maybe it's his 28th. A lot of years that he's been doing this Surimi school. So when I was a grad student, I was a student running the lab and helping and doing all that. And now that I've graduated, this will be the second time that I've gone back and be able to teach all of the, so what the Surimi companies will send their employees here for all of this training. So it's 2.5 days worth of training. So we have class lectures and then lab lectures. And so I'll be teaching the chemistry. So I'm still in contact with him. I still consult with his grad students and help them, you know, I review their papers, talk about SES page with them and help them out on different things. And so since I've graduated, with Dr. Park, I've helped author 2 book chapters and been a co-author on another journal article. So he's trying to keep me active in the academic world so that ultimately it wouldn't be bad if I, you know, the thought has crossed my mind that when he does retire to maybe kind of take over his position right. there in Astoria. I did apply for and made it to the final 3 and went for in-person interviews at Utah State University when they were looking for a new professor in meat science there. Obviously, I didn't get that job.
Right, yeah.
I didn't get that job. And actually, I was number 4 on the list for a position at Oregon State recently, but they were looking for marine nutraceuticals, and so that wasn't, you know, so they had a couple other people that were more suited to that. So
is that building the nutraceutical for the fish to take to make?
No, it's not. Well, there could be some of that, but yeah. No, it's looking at the marine biome as trying to find nutraceuticals for human consumptions. You
oh,
know,
okay.
all the proteins, the different things, because there's a lot of things out there in the ocean that we can use for health benefits
right.
And different things like
that. I don't know. I stopped taking the fish oil. I don't know.
Yeah.
I read some recent article said that the fish oil, after a while, it just doesn't do any good for you, and which worked out fine because I got tired of tasting fish you know, throughout the day
yeah.
with the fish oil tab. But this has been fascinating. How do you, what's your kid think about what you do?
He loves it. You know, he's been exposed to a lot more meat and different things than I was growing up. Like I say, he's our only child, so he gets all of our attention. I grew up as one of seven, so I was probably older than he is now before I really got my taste of a good steak. And it was until I was married till I actually had a ribeye steak.
Then there was no looking back.
And then there was no. Yeah, ribeye is...
It's got to be the bone in also.
Oh, yeah. And a nice big cowboy cut there, mm-hmm. Yeah. But Jackson loves it because I'll make all sorts of different things, and he's the first one that, hey, Jackson, come try this that I made. And he's honest with me. You know, there's been stuff that he absolutely loves. And, you know, so the summer sausage is one of his favorite. He loves that. I made another sausage one time. I don't remember what the flavor was. I think it may have been a Korean kimchi sausage, dried cured sausage that I made. And he tried and he's like, it's okay. Kind of gave me a thumbs down on that one. And I, you know, so he enjoys it. And I asked him the other day, I said, you know, if you had to tell somebody about Dad, you know, what would you say his favorite thing to do? And he said, talk about meat. Apparently he picks up on that.
Well, that's pretty good. Yeah. What do you get a lot of international travel out of your job? Are there other folks? I'm sure there are around the world doing what you do. Do you communicate with those folks at all?
Yeah. So Ingredion is actually a global company, and so the group that I'm in is actually in the global innovation group, and so you know. For a while, they hadn't had anybody specifically with the meat background that I have. And so now that I've started, I've been consulting with all of our regions, you know, with Europe, Asia Pacific, Mexico, and South America. I was trying to finagle a trip to Singapore, but that hasn't quite worked out yet. But there will be international travel. My last job, the headquarters were in the Netherlands, so I went over there for a week to work with them. There may be a possibility to go. Like I say, I'm in charge of our global expertise team in meat, and so all of these different regions. So I bring all of the regions together. So that we can see what's going on in the different areas and share our research and share our problems. I think on Tuesday I have a meeting with our group over in Germany with work that they're working on.
That meeting for you starts at 6 o'clock in the morning.
Exactly.
I play a little bit in that international space too.
Yeah. I do. Like I say, I've been in this role for about 7 months now. And I'm sure I'll get to do more international travel as we go along, which I enjoy. So,
great. Zach Reed, thank you very much.
No problem.
Really appreciate you. Thanks for helping us pilot High and Deep.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Zach Reed, ladies and gentlemen, he is a hoot. We spent about 40 minutes afterwards around the kitchen table talking barbecue and cooking whole hogs. Something tells me he and I will be spending some time together again in the future, probably around a pit smoking some more meat. Got to say thank you very much to Ann Craddock. Ann, you may have unwittingly created a monster. Zach and I will definitely be seeing one another again and hopefully cooking some meat up. That music bed you hear behind me, that's a band called The Aristocrats. They're a fantastic trio of outstanding musicians. That's the tune, The Kentucky Meat Shower, from their album Tres Caballeros. I think you kind of get the idea, The Kentucky Meat Shower. Thank you very much for taking time to listen today. You can check me out on the interwebs at themountaingeek.net. The Twitter podcast, or the Twitter handle, is at PhD Podcast. And you can check us out on the Facebook as well, at Piled High and Deep, the podcast. And by us, I mean the guests. As well. I'm not talking about the royal we. Anyway, I got another episode that I got to get edited up. Next week we'll be dropping our fourth episode of Piled High and Deep, the podcast. Until then, keep shoveling.